Welcome to In Conversation With from Devon Chamber, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Hello and welcome to In Conversation With from the Devon Chamber of Commerce, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. I'm Paul Philpott, Vice Chair of Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and a Director of Devon Chamber. Now, it's not often we have someone back on the podcast as a main guest, but today we make an exception. Our guest was first on In Conversation With in 2021, kind of like after that lockdown phase, when he was an opposition MP. Now his party is in government and he's in the cabinet. So there's been rather a lot going on with a certain individual called Luke Pollard, MP. Hello, Luke.
Hello. Not quite yet in the cabinet. Nearly.
Right, okay, so you'll have to explain then. Are not all ministers sat around that big table?
No, there is a giant table.
Yes.
And there's about 35, 37 people around that table, and they lead a government department each.
Yeah.
And I'm a minister, so I'm the Minister for the Armed Forces, which means on a day-to-day basis, I'm responsible for where our troops are,
mm-hmm.
what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
what they're not doing, and how we respond to international events as a country from a military perspective. And John Healey, who's the Defence Secretary, sits around the cabinet table. So he's lucky he gets a few more meetings than I do every week.
Well, you say that, but I think your Instagram post is like literally, I'm going to London on a train. I'm going back from London on a train. I'm going abroad on a plane. I'm coming back from abroad on a plane. I'm coming back to Plymouth on a train. I'm going up to London again on a train. You're getting around rather a lot. Is it what you expected to be this relatively new life of yours?
I do spend a lot of time on trains. It's certainly true. If you're a West Country MP,
yeah.
I think the best sustainable and most affordable way to get to and from London is the train. It means you can work,
yes.
and occasionally it means I can dive into my Disney Plus and have a little bit of time relaxing. But the work increasingly for the Ministry of Defence is taking me abroad, looking at where the pinch points are in the world, and you can imagine the crises that are affecting international stability at the moment. It's making sure allies are alongside, that we're having all the conversations. And in opposition, you couldn't quite see what diplomacy means.
Mm-hmm.
Have an idea about it. Speaking to allies, building consensus, trying to avoid points of friction. And when you're doing it yourself, when you're building those relationships, I spend a lot of time on conversations on Zoom and other secure type of video messaging services
that
are available. But there's no substitute for being around the table with someone, especially when you're talking about what can be deeply difficult situations.
Mm-hmm.
When you're having conversations with, say, a country on NATO's eastern flank, and they're genuinely concerned that in only a few years' time, Russia will be invading their nation.
Mm.
That's a conversation that I think you need to be present for. You need to be looking people in the eye.
Yes.
You need to be understanding where they're coming from. Because if you don't understand where the person you're speaking to is coming from, it's going to make a productive conversation so much harder. And because of that, and the job I've got, it means I travel a lot, which is a lot. It really is. But I mean, it's an enormous privilege to be able to do it. It like, genuinely is.
We always have to remind our listeners that the Chamber is apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
That said, regardless of which political party, we need to, I believe, celebrate the fact that our local MP is now in such a great position. 4 years ago, when the core element of this journey started, is it what you expect it to be like? Has it been a roller coaster? Where are your emotions right now?
If I think about when I got elected in 2017, I think the country's been in a constant state of crisis, instability, chaos to one extent, pretty much from then onwards. And whether it's been COVID, whether it's been Brexit and the toing and froing of what that meant and what were the implications of a pretty botched deal, especially for many of our core industries, when you saw the invasion of Ukraine, which for many people felt a bit distant, but the amount of Ukrainians that we welcomed into the Southwest, into our homes to look after, brought it home. But it affected every single one of us because the energy prices surged because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
Mm.
There are real world consequences to what happens beyond our borders. It's been an awful lot going on, but I think it means that for folks like myself who are passionate about the West Country, it's given a reason for us to be louder because, you know, my critique of the Southwest in general, and this especially applies to Plymouth, is that we're not loud and proud about what we're good at, and we're not clear and relentless about going after where we need some extra help. We're just quite shy of coming forwards. And I think at this very moment, when there's so much instability in the world, you've got increasing defence spending for the first time since I was in primary school. The last time that a defence review didn't cut the size of the army was in 1987. Mm-hmm. We're increasing the size of the army for the very first time in that period. This is enormous seismic change. And because defence is so important to the Southwest, well, I have to be very careful because I can't take any decisions that would favour Plymouth. My colleagues have to take those decisions for me to make sure that I'm above board in everything we do.
Yeah, fair
but when
enough.
We're increasing defence spending, when we're investing in the capabilities that the Southwest is good at, marine autonomy for Plymouth, for instance, amphibiosity, the support for our nuclear submarines, this is our moment. This is not our time to be shy about our cities or our region's prospects. In fact, if anything, now is a time to give us a kick up the bum.
Yeah.
To say, be loud.
I could tell this is a frustration of yours because I remember in 2021, where you were on a previous episode, there were two things you said. One of them is that we don't shout enough about how good we are in the Southwest.
Very true.
And I've got a feeling you're going to start giving people a phone call and like saying, hey, and also you said about politics is broken. So have you fixed politics yet?
We definitely don't shout enough about our region. And in London, when you are making the case for Plymouth and the Southwest, we're up against this really awkward familiarity problem. And this sounds vaguely party political, so I'll watch you wince on this one here, non-political podcast. But after 2019, when the then Conservative Party won loads of red wall seats, it was really obvious that many of those MPs that were pre-existing from that general election had no idea about these communities, had never been to these red wall seats, didn't care previously, but now did because they had won all those seats. The Southwest suffers from the opposite problem. So many people in power in Westminster have been to Dartmouth, Salcombe, Rock. They've been to the Tate at St. Ives. They feel they know our region because they've been on holiday here. That's a different challenge for us, which means that especially for a city like Plymouth, where we have incredibly high levels of deprivation, but enormous areas of opportunity as well, it means we're not going to be able to resolve that just by banking that people have been on, you know, a train all the way down to Cornwall, enjoyed a cream tea and went back again. We've got to make a more positive case. And I think that has been made so much easier since the general election. And one of the challenges I have to organisations that sometimes say, oh, we're non-party political, is to say, that's fine. I'm not asking you to say support party X or party Y. I'm asking you to have a voice. Be loud about stuff. And I think there's a caution, especially in some of the business community in recent years, about saying anything for fear that it strays over a line about being political. Well, do you know what? I want people to be political. I don't want business to be party political, right? I don't want people to stick a big party logo on
I guess
their
if something's not good enough, there's no harm in actually raising it as a concern.
Absolutely.
Because your aims and your reasoning sound.
Yeah. And I think that's partly where my critique in the past about politics being broken, and I still feel there's lots that needs to be fixed about our politics. If we allow politicians to be separate from our communities, if we allow somehow them to be in a bubble, then actually we're not going to be able to communicate what we need to politicians of whatever party, whoever is in power. So I think as a region, and for especially those business leaders that may be listening to this podcast, it's kind of a challenge to them. It's like, what policy, if different from government, would make a difference to our region? If we invested more in the train line, so it was more secure and faster, if the M5 went beyond Exeter all the way to Plymouth, perhaps even into Cornwall, if we were to able to fix rural broadband, would that make a positive difference to your business?
You know, the answer would be all the above, please.
Oh, absolutely. And so I think there's a real good challenge here. And it's the kind of like, so what question?
Yeah.
So if that's all good for you, what are you going to do about it? And everyone, yes, should vote. And they should vote according to their conscience and what they feel is best for the country, of course. And that's a given. But between elections, the so what is, make the case, be powerful, come together, collaborate more, and be clear with those people in charge, be it locally, nationally, and I hope soon regionally, with regional mayors coming to Devon and Cornwall, I hope, in due course. How do we get the investment we need? Well, we be stronger, we be louder, and that is what we need to be. And for me, the Southwest is awesome, but we should be so much better. And I think if you people watch other regions, and I look at, say, the East Midlands, because of the two regions in the country that over the last decade have had the poorest funding, it's been the Southwest and the East Midlands, and we compete for who's on the bottom between those two. But if I see the way that that region has pulled itself together, say, right, government MPs, you do this type of job, opposition MPs, you do this type of job, here's our priorities, we're all going in the same direction. Since the general election, I now have a new suite of parliamentary colleagues. Labour MPs, Conservative MPs, Lib Dem MPs. And my word, isn't it refreshing? Because we've got people that are working together pretty much for the first time that I can remember. I've always been calling for cross-party working, but when I was the only little red dot with one in Exeter and everything else was blue, I can understand why previous iterations might not be that keen on it because it was unnecessary. But we've got this wonderful tapestry across the Southwest now, and we are stronger when we work together. And I think it's always fine to have a debate around beliefs and party politics.
And I know that's genuine because I've seen you on debates and panels, and it's kind of like backstage, so to speak, where you've got yourself and your peers from other parties. You're actually getting on.
Well, I'm the old man of the region now, which is a disturbing realisation that I've had. And so I look back at some old pictures when I first stood in the seat that I now represent, which was back in 2015.
You're a child.
I had brown hair. I had this youthful look, kind of like unencumbered by the stress of elected office. And I'm now the old man of the region. Yes, there are some people that might have served longer, Geoffrey Cox being one of those in West Devon. But there's loads of newbies that are kind of, I think, looking to that generation that have done the job before.
Yeah.
I said, how do you do this? And I think you can learn different lessons. You can learn that you do it by slamming your opponent's head into a table, metaphorically speaking, by attack, attack, attack. I don't think that's where the public want their politicians at the moment.
I think the public's fed up of that.
I think they absolutely are. I am, as well.
It's dirty politics. It gives the whole industry, for want of a better way of putting it, a bad name.
Yeah.
And of course, it affects future politics. It affects those that want to come into it as a career.
Well, it puts people off.
Because we need talent. We need fresh talent across all politics, local government, national government, and regional. We need new, fresh, young talent. It's never going to improve. It's never going to develop fresh ideas unless that talent comes from somewhere.
You can't be what you can't see. And that means we need to have better role models in every part of our industry. And we need to be reaching out beyond those traditional recruiting grounds, be that for the armed forces, be that for the media, be that for politics, whichever sector you're in. But I think there's something about leading with the behaviours you want to see. And the way that I'd like to see that my contribution to fixing this broken politics is trying not to be overtly party political needlessly. I think you've got to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to bring people in, and you've got to explain why something has happened and what can be done differently. But you've got to do so in a way that I think creates the opportunities for more constructive politics, constructive dialogue with people thinking, do you know what? I could do that.
Yeah.
Because I look out across my city, I see brilliant people in business, in community groups, volunteering, amazing entrepreneurs, people that have served our nation in uniform. And I'm looking at them going, I really wish you were in politics. I wish you were in public service. And so many of them are put off by that half hour once a week when they look at Prime Minister's questions. It's got a lot better since the general election, to be fair, on both sides of the chamber. But they see politicians behaving not always as well as I think they should
do.
And they get put off by that.
I always have this impression that it's some kind of game. It's almost like a bit of a play. It's like a role play. It just happens that way because it's always happened that way.
I think it's a choice about what you do. And I remember, I don't particularly like PMQs. It's a three-line whip, so I have to be there each week. And, you know, if everyone watches it, you'll normally see me standing behind the speaker's chair. It's the easiest place to escape from, shall I say, in this situation. And I'd leave as soon as I can.
Yeah.
It's not, for me, politics at its best. Politics at its best is often the debates that don't get many views. They're when you have a deep discussion, when you bring evidence, where you bring a passion. And yeah, I like it when people have different views.
Talking about that then, is there anything that surprised you about life inside government? Is it what you expected it to be? Because I've kind of got this impression that the opposition, you know, all the members of that opposition don't actually know what happens the other side of the black doors of Downing Street until they're actually in there. It seems crazy to me that, you know, you wouldn't have some kind of transparency inside and outside, but it just seems the actual reality is far stranger than what you think it may well be.
It is. I mean, there's been a few people that we have in government now who served in either Tony Blair's or Gordon Brown's government, but that was 14 years ago between elections. I'd never served in government prior to this. I've only been an opposition MP since I was elected in 2017. And there's a few things that have surprised me. Firstly, it is Yes Minister and the thick of it all at the same time. You find yourselves in situations increasingly where you go like, how do we get here? I've got the thick of it quotes in my head, far too much swearing in the thick of it, so
good,
I won't be using
that's
it here,
fine,
don't
yes,
I?
Yeah.
But you feel that there's those examples of just how ridiculous the world can be. I see amazing people working really hard. And I think one thing that is an easy place to kick in politics is to blame the civil servants. I've been incredibly amazed at the talent, the ability, the energy and passion of those people that work in defence, both the military side and the civilian side. And I didn't always think that would be the case. I thought that there would be a greater lethargy. And I've been pleasantly surprised by that. And I think that is not the case for every colleague, but for me, it's been a good experience. But there are things, especially when you are looking after so much stuff that is held at a high classification, that's quite surprising. And certainly you've seen the news recently. As the minister who's responsible not just for our armed forces, but also for Afghan relocations, being welcomed into the department, congratulations, minister, we have something to tell you. Here's a secret relocation scheme that we haven't told anyone about, and you're running it. That was quite a day at the office.
Yes, I can imagine.
And so there are things, I think, that surprise me by dint of, oh my God, they've done what previously? But I think on the whole, I see across government, good people working hard. And to be honest, that's why I say at local councils as well. It's never fashionable to say anything nice about local government. But I see brilliant people in local councils trying to work hard, often with very little resource after years of cuts. But I think if we start from, I see a glass half full rather than half empty. I'm just annoyingly bouncy in that respect. But that means I think you've got more to build on. And at a time when our country is facing quite significant challenges, how we get our economy back on track, how we create growth in the economy, how we deal with a world that's more unstable than it has ever been with changing international structures, I think you've got to start from being hopeful. And I think we're suffering from a bit of a lack of hope as a nation. This has not just been the last 12 months. This is over the last 5-10 years. It feels like we could do with being more positive, not just to cheer ourselves up, but because actually many of the solutions to the really difficult problems we have are in our hands.
Kind of bring back the gung-ho can-do attitude, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of that kind of entrepreneurial spirit that the kind of like thrusting executive and the pioneer can often bring to it. But there's also just something about, do you remember when people went out of their homes and clapped for public sector workers,
yes,
the nurses and doctors in the NHS during COVID? And then only a few years later, there's folks saying, oh, sack them all, they shouldn't be getting paid decently and things like that. It's like, I don't buy this stuff. We have brilliant people in our country. Let's start celebrating those and let's realise that so many of the problems we're facing at the moment could be dealt with by treating each other with a bit more respect, a bit more decency than we've seen. That's not going to work in every scenario. And look, it's politics. I'm acutely aware of how this game is played. But I think if you are more decent, if you try and bring more evidence and facts and structure to an argument, I think we will be able to put off fewer people and we might be at risk of encouraging some folks to look again, look afresh at how politics is run.
You use the term game, and I guess that's fair to say that politics is a bit of a game in some instances, and it's also a massive machine. And when we hear about things going wrong, and they get covered, and obviously the press will spin it to whatever the news agenda of the day needs it to be spun to. Is it because these things are such big machines, things naturally do go wrong? Because you're running a country. This is major, complex, mechanical stuff.
I think in most cases, I see cock-up more than conspiracy.
Yeah.
And the idea that central government could run incredible conspiracies is something that I just don't buy. I think they can hide stuff from the public. I think there can be stuff that things are not as transparent as perhaps I would like them to be, something that we are trying to change as a new government. But I don't buy the malign intent that's often attributed. But the economy is really big. Government budget is really big. I mean, defence's budget alone is £67 billion this year. That's £67,000 million.
It's a big number.
It's an extraordinary amount of money. It needs to be bigger still to meet the threats that we're facing. But that means you've got to spend that much better than I think we have. And I think one of the bits for me about how you spend that money better is I can sit in main building in the Ministry of Defence on Whitehall, just opposite Downing Street, and I can make decisions, I can sign bits of paper, send out orders. For me, the test of it is how is someone on the front line who's manufacturing something for the military? How are those people who are working in Devonport Dockyard or perhaps some of the Royal Marines that are based at Bickley or Stonehouse in Plymouth? How are they going to feel about some of this stuff? And I think there's a temptation to get yourself sucked into the trap of just thinking big. You've got to think strategically and high level. Absolutely. You do need to do that because we're facing big challenges. You've got big budgets. It's right to do that. But I think you've got to have in mind that if you want to achieve change, it's not about motivating the upper echelons of the civil service or business. It's about helping people on average salaries who go to work, who work really hard, who look after their family life. How do you have effects that reach them? And that's harder because the economy is more complex. The challenges are more difficult. but you've still got to do it. And I think we are slowly making progress, but I'm an impatient so-and-so, so I want stuff to happen faster. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I can reassure everyone who's listening that that is the case of all my colleagues. There's lots of improvement, but we want it faster.
Yeah. We all know you're incredibly passionate about Plymouth, the Southwest region, especially defence. Can you tell us about some of the things that you're working on for the region? What big projects and what amazing things are we likely to see in the not too distant future for the area?
Well, if I just look at defence at the moment, we're spending currently £4.5 billion building new submarine docks at Devonport Dockyard. That is an enormous amount of money. Mm. And roughly speaking, the old docks don't quite fit the new shape of submarines. The technology's changed and we need to update them so we can refit some of our latest nuclear submarines. That's what Devonport is good at. We're the only place in the country that can do this. Now, if I was spending £4.5 billion outside of the dockyard in the wider economy, it would be headline news every day. But because so much of defence is spent behind a big wall, behind the idea of secrecy, we're not able to make that change. Now, 4.5 billion is tens of thousands of jobs. We have now 25,000 job opportunities in the dockyard and the supply chain over the next decade. We have so many jobs, we don't have enough houses in Plymouth for them. So we have this enormous challenge and opportunity ahead. The recent announcement about increasing spend on autonomous systems. These are kind of weapon systems, sensors, boats, planes that don't have people driving them, that are driven by remote connections. Well, we're the best place in the country that does that. That's here in Plymouth, using a supply chain that spans the Southwest. These are amazing things. They're also something that we can talk about. And I think there's a hesitancy in Plymouth sometimes, just as about the hiding our light under a bushel than hide the bushel. But there's a hesitancy sometimes to talk about defence because it should be secret. You know, loose lips sink ships from the Second World War. Well, yes, I'm not asking anyone to tell the public around what is the capabilities of that rocket system or the propulsion system, what speed does a craft go at. I'm trying to say, tell people it's an amazing place to start an apprenticeship. It's an amazing place to invest. And when you start doing that, that £4.5 billion that's going on submarine docks, well, that is even more when you think about how many young people are going to be taken on by the skilled trades that are needed to build it. How much supply chain benefit will we see? And I think we've got to be better at using defence as an engine for growth. We've got to be better at saying, yes, Devonport isn't just the largest naval base in Western Europe. It supports tens of thousands of jobs across our entire region. Just that one base alone, let alone when you think about the contribution that the other military bases across our region do, the defence industries, the people that make a bit that goes in another bit, that goes another bit, that goes in a tanker and a frigate. Defence really is something that is the economic backbone of our region. And we've stopped talking about it. And if we don't talk about our strengths, we shouldn't be surprised where we don't get a lot of focus on anything else that we want to talk about as a region.
The Devon Business Show is back. Devon Chamber is bringing the Southwest's largest business event back to Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday, the 15th of October, connecting hundreds of businesses and entrepreneurs with future clients all under one roof. With over 125 exhibitors, interactive stands, live podcasts, a networking hub, and guests from across the city and the county, this is the not-to-be-missed date for your diaries. There are many ways to get involved, including a launch party on the 1st of July, where you can enjoy a cocktail and canapés at Tinside Lido overlooking the Sound. Plus, our pre-show networking breakfast at Home Park's Mayflower Grandstand on the day. A limited number of stands are available. Book yours now at devonchamber.co.uk. The Devon Business Show at Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday the 15th of October. Let's get working at networking.
This is interesting because obviously in order to realise these projects, it becomes a catalyst for businesses of many different shapes and sizes across the entire UK, but obviously within the region as well. But it also leads me back to that concept of local procurement as well, and how these projects support the supply chain all the way down to the SMEs and the micro businesses, which make up a massive part of our economy. It's still, to me personally, this isn't the view of the chamber, but it still seems that getting on board with those supply chain methodologies and getting those contracts and being able to work and supply whatever type of widget, whatever type of creative that your business does to that massive machine that is defence, is just too difficult. And it doesn't seem that those opportunities are correctly advertised, that I may well be wrong, that the barriers to get past those procurement stages are far too complicated and far too expensive for the micro businesses to be able to supply. Therefore, it becomes the realm of the larger businesses to do it. Therefore, the prices go up. Therefore, the Ministry of Defence doesn't get value for money because it's overpaying, because it's buying wrongly. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I could go on about that all day.
And you'd be welcome to. And I would agree with every word that you said. And I think our defence procurement system is broken. We inherited a system where of our, I think it's 49 major projects, only 47 were in the red. Only two were working well. 47 were not. They were over time and over budget. So it's clearly not working. Direct spend on SMEs in defence had gone down from the dizzy heights of 5% in 2019 to only 4% in July last year. Now, we'll be setting out with a new defence industrial strategy later this year how we want to increase that number of direct spend. And sometimes people can make the case that defence is complicated and you do need to have big primes getting contracts. Absolutely. The likes of Babcock, BE, Thales, they will continue to get big contracts. There'll be thousands employed by that. But I want more of our contracts going to small businesses. And although I'm not responsible for defence procurement, I am in one respect. I'm responsible for defence procurement of the equipment and support that we send to our friends in Ukraine. And that is done on a completely different system. It's fast. It's agile. It is hyper-responsive to the needs of the battlefield, because the people who are fighting and dying every day in Ukraine to defend against Russian aggression, they're fighting for our freedom as just as much as they're fighting for their own. And when they're needing a different type of drone, we've got to make sure they can get it. And we are providing, I think this year, £4.5 billion-ish. It's £3 billion on average a year, but we're using the interest from the seized Russian assets this year to boost that. And many of those businesses that are getting those contracts, they're incredibly agile SMEs. Now, they're precisely the businesses that I want procuring to UK forces more. Because if Ukraine sends an order, we can place it on a Monday. It can be built during the week. It can be put and shipped out to Ukraine. And by the end of that week, that drone predominantly can be facing off Russian forces. Now, that type of agility, that type of speed is what's going to be necessary to defend our country in the future. But it also is a different way of ordering. It's a different way of managing your business, different way of managing your cash flow. But we need that because we're moving from a period of peacetime into one where we need to be ready for war fighting. That is a difficult message. And that is not just about saying, okay, we need to increase more on defense spending, stick it in a corner, crack on with it. That is a deep challenge to the way that our businesses are run, the way that we procure, the way that we work with the NHS, the way that we work with our career services. How do we make sure that we are better able? Because if we are better able to be ready for war fighting, we're less likely to need it. And this for me really matters. I don't want a war with Russia. I want us to deter a war with Russia. We do that by demonstrating not only do we have the very best armed forces, that we have a strong nuclear deterrent, but in the event of the balloon going up, we have an industry that stands behind our forces that is agile, fast, and can produce the missiles, the tanks, the frigates, the autonomous systems, the drones that we would need at pace almost straight away. And I think we have in defence told ourselves this bit of a fib over many years that when needed, don't worry, industry will turn on. And what I've seen since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine is, yes, some industries turned on, but some of it hasn't. And if we want to be ready, and I think this is not an optional extra, where there's a necessity for us to do so, we have to change the way we procure. We have to change the way that we evolve. And as an example, I talk about drones in Ukraine. First-person view drones. That's a drone flown by someone with an Xbox controller. Now account for 2/3 of all battlefield casualties in Ukraine. It would be artillery, but it's 2/3 battlefield casualties are now drones. The British Army has a drone. It was 14 years old. We retired that when we came into office because it would not survive in Ukraine. Each 2 to 3 weeks in Ukraine, they have to upgrade their entire fleet of drone technology because the electronic warfare environment has changed so substantially.
That's crazy.
That the previous drones from a fortnight ago no longer have the survivability, the effectiveness they do.
Yeah.
So if we believe that we can just polish some of our old capabilities And to be honest, I like old kit. Some of the amazing old frigates and amphibious ships in Devonport, they're amazing. But if we don't have the latest kit and if we can't iterate it, so invest in the new technology, spiral develop it and have a procurement system that enables that, it's not going to work in warfare. And I don't want to be in a situation where I'm asking our people in uniform to go into battle with kit that's not going to be effective for them. That's why this change is so
really interesting. But it's also the fact that it's the reality of things. You know, when you're in there and you're able to see the situation with your own eyes, the reality that we have quite dated technology in certain industries that perhaps, again, I might be completely wrong, but sometimes it seems to be that you spend more money on a project rather than spend smarter on the project. And you think, oh, that's ran over by so-and-so billion pounds. And you're like, how on earth, with every expletive, is that even possible? Either somebody didn't write the brief properly, or somebody didn't control the finances properly, or you lost the accountant somewhere. Because some of the figures that we're talking about, when they drift, are so extreme. And also deadlines. You know, I work in an industry where deadlines are key. Every hour there's something. If you miss it, you're out. It just seems that it doesn't apply to certain other industries, especially within the walls of government. And I won't name them, but a member of my family works for a defence firm elsewhere, and saying they're still running on paper systems. Things have to be signed and duplicate, triplicate, quadruplicate or whatever. It could be replaced by an iPad. And his job for the entire day was just to replace a light bulb, figuratively speaking. And it's like, he doesn't feel utilised. So it seems there's a lot of fixing that needs to go on with regards to the efficiencies. That's a big task to take on.
If I use a non-defence example, Wes Streeting, who's the health secretary, banned fax machines in the NHS. Because in July 2024, there were still fax machines being used in our National Health Service.
Right, okay.
And so this is the kind of, when we talk about the inheritance that we kind of get, people roll their eyes and not everyone wants to go over the £22 billion black hole every time. But most of us know that the systems weren't quite working the way they needed to. And it depends how far down that journey you want to allow yourself to go. And sometimes personal politics will get you down to one end or the other faster than others. But our systems weren't working. We weren't smart and efficient on these things. And if I look at defence procurement, one of the biggest problems was actually defence itself. We were ordering a bit of kit, and then 6 months later, we'll change the spec. And then we'll change the spec 6 months later. And one of the changes that we have made, which will profoundly improve the efficiency of our stuff, is we said, right, we're going to export all our technologies. Which means no more Gucci UK-only gear that we've specced so extremely well that we can no longer afford the thing that we originally ordered or how many that we originally wanted. And no one wants to buy it because it's too expensive on the international marketplace. We're going to make stuff that our allies want to buy. And because of that, we're not going to have this iteration of specking it there, but we are going to make technology that's going to be spiral developed. So you can iterate it once it's in the marketplace, once it's on the front line. Now, those type of changes are quite profound.
Well, it seems that it's also going to involve a cultural change.
Absolutely.
In order to deliver this, how people write specs, how they work, their entire mental approach to delivery.
Yep. But I know it works. So the thing about this is, for me, this is not just an abstract concept of efficient procurement. It's not a Yes Minister episode. I see the same people who work on Ukraine for one half of the week, hyper-efficient organization, delivering incredibly to our allies. And when the full story of their contribution can be told, I think the nation will be extraordinarily proud of them. And then the other half of the week, having to work on UK procurement, and it's slow. Now, that says to me that we are not allowing our people to do the job that they could be doing. So we're getting rid of outdated procurement rules. We're making it faster. We want to drive more SMEs into the procurement. They're more agile. They're faster in delivering. And I think that change will take some time.
And cheaper.
I think they will be cheaper.
Well, better value for money, I think, is probably the better way of putting it.
And I think when you're in a situation where we have correctly given much of our stockpiles and our ammunition and our spare platforms to our friends in Ukraine who are using them, who really value UK kit, they think it's brilliant. But that means our cupboards are not very full. And that's not giving away anything classified by saying that. Our job is to fill them up at pace.
That's okay. We can edit this anyway.
But you've got to, I think, have a system where you can press play, both on procurement, but also on reserves, on our people. Now, we inherited a retention and recruitment crisis, which meant for every 100 people joining the armed forces, 130 were leaving. That's not good enough. Do you know what? We inherited a situation where people were in uniform earning less than the living wage. Well, that's gone. Everyone now earns a living wage. We have increased pay to make sure that was the case. Biggest pay rise in 20 years for armed forces. You've got to start valuing our people more. And for me, it's a very basic thing. If you feel valued at work, whatever your job, whether you're serving on the front line protecting the nation or whether you're working in office, if you feel valued, you put you more into it, you stay longer, you invest more, you do more training, you feel that there is a benefit for you turning up to work every day. But when we had our armed forces that were barely getting a pay rise for over a decade, that were being asked and told, instructed in many cases, to live in appalling accommodation with black mold, damp, leaky roofs for them and their families, well, no wonder people were thinking about an alternative career, because we were not valuing them as a nation. That has started to change. An extra $1.5 billion into defence housing, biggest pay rise for 20 years. Recruits now get 34% pay rise, which means everyone's earning the living wage for the very first time. That should have been the case for a very long time. Value our people more, they'll stay, they'll be better. And that is the kind of stuff that ultimately, if Putin's looking over the border, looking at NATO and thinking, can I have a go? If he sees a stronger set of armed forces, not just the UK's, but all our NATO allies, a faster procurement system, better tech, he's going to think again about doing so. And that is how we keep our people safe. These are big challenges to get there, but you know, I feel incredibly fortunate that I am allowed to be part of this. I think it helps being a Plymouth MP, because defence is what we do here.
And it's in your blood, really.
Yeah, I'm proud to be a Navy brat. Like, my old man was a submariner. Yeah. And you know, certainly when I go around Devonport, there's quite a few people that look at the face and go, oh, you're Jeff's son, aren't you? Sadly, the nose has not escaped me in the DNA.
Bringing this back round to you specifically, this is a different Luke. You're where you want to be now. It just seems that you've now got something. Does that make sense?
I love my job. I love being an MP. I love the fact that I get to talk about Plymouth, my home, all the time. And I think at this very moment, we need people that give a toss about defence to be in roles that are defence facing. But the last few years have been different. You know, I think everyone came out of COVID different from how they came in. I've got married, and that has changed some of the outlook on life. Went through cancer, came out the other side. And I think all those experiences, because I just roll from one thing into another, and this job tends to do that, sometimes it doesn't provide the moment for you just to take a pause and go, oh, quite a lot of stuff's happened here.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, possibly. And I think, you know, when you're looking ahead, like, we've got 4 years left of this government. I don't know what jobs Keir will want me to do, whether he'll want me to stay in this one or do something different or return me to the backbenches. But I do know that I get to represent a place that I love for 4 more years. And I think in those 4 years, I want to put my heart and soul into doing stuff that makes a difference. So, like, before I came to see you, I had a meeting with Care Leavers. And Care Leavers are, for me, one of my kind of like personal passions. I think we have completely forgotten about kids in care as a nation. They're out of sight, out of mind for us. And in Plymouth, we have currently about 500 kids in care. And across Devon, there'll be thousands. And I just look at some of the changes we've been able to get in place to help kids in care, and hopefully nearly on the cusp of being able to create a nationwide rent guarantee scheme. So when they leave care at 18, they'll be able to get a place without having to pretend there's a bank of mum and dad, because in many cases there's not for them. I kind of think if I keep going like this, we can make a difference to those kids. Now, does that help me get re-elected or not? Probably not. Is it worth doing? Is it worth spending time on something that I know makes a difference? Yes. And I think by the time the next general election, I'll have been doing this job for 12 years. I started with brown hair, have grey hair now. Different experience. But I think my focus is on making this city better than it is today, because we live in a brilliant place. We have brilliant people, but we discard too many of our young people. We write them off too early as a city. We accept this stubborn level of deprivation, which means for folks that live on Union Street in Plymouth, you're in the bottom 0.2% of super output economic measure in the entire country, not in Plymouth, but in the entire country. The health village that I'm trying to get built in the city centre, which is not just diagnostics, it's GPs, it's health services. Around there, we've got the new community diagnostic centre being built on the Colin Campbell Court car park. We've got a dental hub being built. I want a primary care hub there. I want us to build more diagnostics there. I want sexual health moved from the hospital onto the high street. So we're taking it out of a clinical environment and making it just like going to a dentist. But the thing that for me is very powerful about that, yes, it will help people across the city. But Stonehouse, right next to where this health centre is being built, accounts for 20% of the emergency department admissions at Derriford. And if you can improve the prevention, the access to healthcare, even a wee bit there, That's going to have enormous impacts for the quality of life for people in that community. And I think I'm extraordinarily lucky I get to do this job. I'm not entirely convinced that all the people that follow me on Facebook share that view of me doing this, certainly by the comments. And I know that politics is a pretty brutal place at times, but I still think it is the best place to be to make change. And I want our city to lift itself up. I want the region to do so. And I think on the cusp, we mentioned it earlier about devolution. Like if Devon gets the devolution powers, that sounds quite abstract. That's hundreds of millions of pounds a year that we get to spend on our priorities, not determined by someone in Westminster or Whitehall, but determined by people who live in Devon. Now, that is, I think, transformative to the options about which transport scheme would you actually like to fund rather than which one fits this criteria. Which schools would we actually like to upgrade? Where can we put more skills in so we could actually fund more skills for fishing, for instance? We could fund more skills for tourism. We can put the pipes across the countryside that will connect our communities with proper high-speed internet.
And I guess also allowing the various stakeholders, including business, to have their say as well.
Absolutely.
I hope that's indeed the case.
But I want businesses to be louder as well. This is not a one-way street.
Oh, yeah,
here.
You've already said, you know, we need to speak up loudly. Going back to what I was saying earlier, you're always on. You answered a question about yourself with lots of pertinent and quite worthwhile information, things that people do need to know. But you are always on. What does your partner think about this now that you're in this far more elevated role? Well, you're always on a train.
Sydney sometimes joins me on the train, so he can see it. I think he knows that this is not a permanent role.
Yeah.
And I think one of the advantages of being in a marginal seat, something that you have to fight every time to win, is that you know it's not for life. I'm not going to be an MP by the time I'm 65. The electoral changes in Plymouth will have swept me aside long before that. And he knows it's not permanent. And because of that, I think he can sometimes go along with, this is ridiculous, but okay.
Right.
I know you love it. I know this makes a difference to you. He's a dancer and he loves his art. And because we both have ridiculous roles, doing different things, that really helps.
They're really quite opposite.
They really
you
are.
You say opposites attract, but you've got Armed Forces Minister and dancer.
I mean, he's fabulous. And actually, I think you're right about being always on. I'm always on unless I decide I'm not. And the space for me in Plymouth where I decide that I'm not is normally 20 metres out to sea when I'm wild swimming.
Yes, you mentioned. I remember you do those crazy things.
But at that point, I can go, right, I'm cold. Everyone around me is cold. Mm. We're all trying to swim to the swim buoy and back. And you're in a space where you can let some of your troubles just wash away and you can just focus on stuff.
But this always on, is this kind of what life is like when you are an MP? I mean, it's obviously not a 9-to-5. Anybody who watches politics on TV will see it's clearly not a 9-to-5 because it's midnight and there's sometimes still debates going on. I'm pleased you say it's not going to be forever because you couldn't keep that up forever. It's not a sustainable work-life balance.
I think that's probably right. And I think I've seen colleagues burn out.
Yeah.
And I think if I look at the US system as a way to compare yourself to, I look at the Senate and there's people in their 80s and 90s in senior roles making decisions. I'm like, no, I want to retire by then. I want to spend time with my family. I want to do stuff that's outside the world of politics. And I think the advantage that I have is I know that this is not forever, so I can run at stuff because you've got a limited amount of time to make a maximum amount of difference. And whenever this crazy world finishes for me, at whatever point that will be in terms of the electoral cycle, I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror and say, yeah, okay, on to the next thing. I don't like regrets that
much. So the cool bit, when you got your role, I thought, crumbs, and I see you on TV in foreign countries, I'm thinking, that must be rather cool. Do you get like armed escorts and things like that? I mean, obviously you don't do it when you're going shopping in Tesco in Plymouth or whatever the case may be, but when you're abroad, please tell me you get armed escorts because I'm just really not interested if you don't.
So you invite me to talk about security, which I'm definitely not allowed to go and do.
No.
What I would say is there's a few of my mates in politics who are now in roles where they have to be protected 24/7.
Absolutely.
And I think the it's cool lasts for about half an hour.
Mm.
Because if you have someone beside you at all time, if the spontaneity of life is gone because they have to check out everywhere you go ahead of going there, I think you cocoon yourself, yes, in a secure box because you are safe and they are there because you are not safe, which I think is a really important understanding. That's a big shift. And I think in a time where we are facing both state threats, so state-sponsored activities, as well as homegrown extremism, I think anyone who steps forward to do politics should be more reassured that they are safe and secure for them and their families. I think we should have no truck for people who threaten violence against any politician. There's loads of politicians whose politics I do not like. They should be able to go home to their families at the end of the day. It should be for the people to decide who represents
Absolutely,
them.
Absolutely.
And I think we're allowing ourselves to fall into a bit of a trap around security that says, do you know what, for this group of people over here, it's okay if they get bashed. Now, I'm very vocal about being an out MP. And I get, as you may know, a fair amount of abuse because I happen to have the temerity to marry the man that I love. If we allow ourselves to say, it's okay for some people to get abuse, like, oh, you just don't need to be public about it. You know, if you just didn't put a picture of your other half on socials, you'd be okay. If you didn't walk down the street with the man you love, it would be okay. You start othering people. And for me, what's really important, which I hope I still come across on my social medias, because I still do them, is I want to be authentic. Life's too short to remember what you lied about, right? Be authentically yourself. And that is a message for anyone that might be thinking about public service in whatever party. Like, be yourself. Be true to who you are and your passion about it. Bring yourself and turn up. And I think as part of that, you've got to be confident that in a more difficult world, that folks will look after you. But do you know what? I think people do. The amount of trolls compared to the amount of decent people that we have in the Southwest, well, they're outnumbered tens of thousands to one.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's not give those trolls, those people who seek to other others, to bottle up, to constrain our politics or the debate or put people off on deliberately. Let's not let them win.
The last time I saw you on a panel, it was an LGBTQ plus, all the letters, discussion at Womblebond Dickinson. And you were there with some other representatives mm-hmm. from professional gay individuals. And I recall seeing a slide that was brought up. And the position of the United Kingdom in terms of its ranking globally with regards to openness and accessibility and respect for one another has fallen quite a few mm-hmm. places. I was quite disturbed by that. But furthermore, discussions went and touched on the international scene and how certain European countries are perhaps nowhere near as liberal and welcoming as they should be. And they've got governments that are trying to oppress equal opportunities and gay rights. Is there anything you feel that you could do in your position within a government in order to correct that dialogue on an international scale? And do you not sometimes think we could call up that leader and say, you're out of line and... Or is it just not the done thing?
I think how you influence people is a entirely fair debate. And if I look at the messages that I get, especially on social media, where people can fire off something quickly rather than email that people spend time composing, I think there's sometimes a sense of just do the thing that you need to do straight away, be angry, get it out there.
Right, okay.
I understand the moments that people want gur. They just want you to express outrage because they're outraged. Well, quite often, I'm also outraged by the same issue that they're getting in touch with me about. But I care more about the effect, right? So how do you ultimately get to the better place? And I think we need to be very alive to the fact that over the last 20, 30, 40 years in particular, where we've seen real progress on LGBT rights, but not just LGBT rights, there has been, I think, a temptation for some folks, especially those in more affluent environments, where they are not seeing oppression or discrimination against them, to believe that the fight for equality is somehow over, that we've reached the chosen land and we're now fine. Thank you very much. I've never had that view. As a kind of awkward, spotty gay teenager, I wasn't in London or Brighton or Canal Street or Manchester. You know, I've always been in the regions and I've always had a different perspective on that. And I think the bit that I think I try to make the case for is a bit of decency to people. Because if we allow othering within our debate, and I think there is more of that creeping in, once you start with othering one group, it never stops there. The question I ask people is like, where does the full stop go? So if it's okay now to attack trans people, spoiler alert, it's not. Is the full stop after trans people? Or actually, are some of the people motivated by that actually want to attack gay people? And I think there's a real challenge for us about how do we conduct what can be very difficult, well-held debates with decency. And I think the algorithms on social media, the way our society is going, encourages us to clash, encourages us to be as extreme as we can, and then rewards us for that, the gur. They don't reward for outcomes. They don't reward decency. The algorithm is not there to create compromise. And I think we need to be very alive to that because our society can choose which way it wants to go. We can choose a path that says, do you know what? Live your life. Or we can choose the path of division.
Yes.
And I think we have to be careful about which one we choose because there are consequences to both. But there's only one path that allows people to live their lives and be free to be themselves. And the other one that will force people to be hidden, will force people out of public life, will beat and murder people and create an environment where hate rules the day. And I think as a nation, when presented with those two choices, we will choose one over the other easily. But when that is broken down to, what about this group of people over here? What about that group of people over there? Then I think some of the same decency is not always present in that debate. And I want to see us have a bit more dignity for people, a bit more decency. I think that reflects my view of politics in general. And if we do that, we'll probably find out that we have more in common than we don't, which is a really important concept. But just finish with this one. I bring this to my work in the Ministry of Defence as well. And the example I use is, in the event of a war, if I've deployed our troops onto the front line, I want everyone in that trench to not care about the person next to them, but who they love, who they worship, what skin colour or background they have. All I want to know is that each other have each other's backs. And that is equality. That is an application in the most profound sense of how our armed forces show the best of our British values. That equality, that decency, that some people may argue it's uniformity. I don't think it is. I think it is unity and diversity. But it's the fact that it doesn't matter someone's background. It matters what they're going to do against that mission, against the values. And when confronted with that, it's amazing how many people go, oh, well, yes, okay. So the alternative of that is, oh, yeah, but Bob over there, well, Bob's gay, so actually we don't care about if Bob gets hit with a grenade. Like, really? I think you do. I think you care about everyone in your troop, everyone in your unit. And at that point, I think the case for equality has been made. And all you have to then do is kind of look at them and go, So apply that elsewhere.
It is an excellent analogy. Finally, what's next for Luke Pollard?
I've got a job to do. I don't know what's going to happen with the world. And as the minister responsible for...
You don't have a crystal ball.
I get a lot of intelligence reports. We've got a lot of stuff that we have an idea of what might happen next. But the world is quite uncertain. And getting darker.
That must take its toll a bit sometimes. Knowing things that I don't know, they don't know.
You have to be able to compartmentalise. And you have to also know how to look after yourself in these situations. So I can't go home and tell the other half of, oh, guess what I read today? That's not something that's available to me. But that's not available for most people, I think. Most people can't say stuff due to privacy or data protection rules with other partners. You got to know how to look after yourself. And I think I've now done this job in government now for just over a year. I've been an MP for the patch in Plymouth, Sutton and Devonport for now 8 years. Kind of got an idea. Not getting lost around main building anymore in the MOD. I know what I'm doing, got clear priorities, just need to go at it. But the bit that I really want to see, especially in the next year, is there's been a lot of heavy lifting to sort out stuff that was wrong, the broken bits. And I want to build some stuff. I want all that effort that's gone into last year and the pain of like really tough political decisions to now result in 1,000 more homes built in the city centre. So I want some cranes up. I want our health village to be built. So I want to see those doors of those new buildings open and people getting tests and scans in a better way than they did before. I'm impatient to see that change. And I think the public are as well. So for me, the next bit is about just like a laser focus on getting stuff done. And I think that will make our city better. I think it will improve the outcomes, in particular for some of the most vulnerable people who don't often have a voice in politics, who are often neglected by people in power. They're a group of people that I've focus on deliberately. I'm a Labour politician, so I guess that's kind of with the bag, but I think that's a personal choice about who you spend your time looking after. And if we do that, we become a better city, become a better region, and I think we'll have better growth, we'll have more money to spend on public services, we'll be able to sort out more problems. But there's plenty to do, so plenty to keep me busy.
Yes, and probably a few more whaley trips ahead of you. Luke Pollard, thank you very much for joining me on In Conversation With.
Thank you.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, helping with all your business and personal taxation needs. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios, full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. copyright Devon Chamber and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.